having me out here, and I had a blast at the Taj Mahal last night at the Taj Mahal, which is Tom Amania's place, and got picked up this morning by the little roadrunner, Tony. Yeah, Tony Blankenship. He was yawning about an hour into it. I said, am I wearing you out? That was kind of funny. If you know Tony, he's like a mile a minute. It was a blast. And we just had a great time harassing people and just laughing and just ate some great food and spent way too much money, and it was good. But not out of control money, which is a change. Responsible spending, that's a change. Anyway, so I have no idea what I'm going to do. So I was going to do what my previous sponsor did and what my current sponsor does at things like this and ask you what you want, since I'm here to be of service to y'all. So I thought we'd just kind of introduce ourselves, and if you just tell me who you are and how long you're sober and what you're looking for this weekend, that'll help me. So yeah, so that's all right with y'all. And what kept coming to me was that my sponsor used to tell me all the time, he goes, Val, if you want to get to know God, you got to get to know God's kids. And at these things, that's the most important thing that happens. It's not necessarily who you've got talking or how profound what they have to share is. It's about what happens after the person's done talking. The magic that happens with one alcoholic talking to another alcoholic, one Al-Anon talking to another alcoholic, talking about recovery, that's where God is. So I'll ramble on and stuff, and God knows I can talk about myself ad nauseum. But that's the most important thing that happens here. And so you know that I'm a real alcoholic, I'll tell you a little bit about me. I come from an alcoholic home. My dad is an alcoholic. He's sober today, 26 years. I grew up in that kind of insanity. Lots of violence and craziness, and my mother chasing him around with frying pans and him bringing women home to say. So that's how I grew up. My mom married a pilot. They got divorced, and my mom married a pilot in the Navy, and we moved around a lot. So I loved the geographic. Even before I picked up a drink, I was ready to go when it was time to go. And a lot of that is because I never fit before I ever took a drink. There was something terribly wrong with me before I ever picked up a drink. And I absolutely was one of those people who was on the outside looking in. I never connected. I always wanted to connect with people, but I just couldn't. I used to blame that on my family, and I used to blame that on my mother had a square nipple, whatever. that's why I'm so different. That's why I can't connect with people. And today I think that's my alcoholism. I have defective relationships. I am absolutely separated on my own. I'm separated from you and from God. So I was waiting for a drink. I needed a drink. The first place I found some power, though, my sponsor used to talk to me about that all the time, that Valerie is, we're power seekers. We love power. Something that's going to make me feel whole and a sense of power and that everything's okay. And the first place I found that power was being a thief. And I used to go sneak over to my friend's house, steal her toys and put them underneath my bed. And they knew exactly where to go. They knew who took the toys immediately. I was like the neighborhood pariah. At 5, it was bad. I didn't have close-knit relationships. When I had my first drink, I was 14 going on 15, and I was ready to have a drink. And it was absolute magic for me, no question. And I got sick, and I got in trouble, and engaged in immoral behavior, and I couldn't wait to do it again. I didn't care. What happened to me was so profound. It was like a spiritual awakening. my head stopped. That huge hole in my gut was gone. That overwhelming sense of fear was gone. Me not knowing what to say to you or how to be around you was gone. So I didn't care what the price was that I had to pay in order to drink again. I was willing to pay it. And I immediately started pursuing drinking with a vengeance. And within a period of a year, and these were all, not that this is what makes me alcoholic, but to try to illustrate to you how hard I went after it. Within a year, I was labeled an ungovernable by the state of Florida, habitual truant, habitual runaway, transit youth centers, juvenile detention centers. And those were all consequences of my drinking or me trying to get the money to drink. So I didn't care. What's the price I have to pay? I'll pay it. If it makes all of this go away, all that internal unmanageability, if the pain stops here and here, I'll do whatever I have to do. So so when I was getting ready to turn 16, my parents, you know, and that's what started the rounds of psychiatrists and psychologists, and God knows I've been saved numerous times. I've been dipped, dunked, and turned over twice. You know what I'm saying? I've been confirmed twice because the first one didn't take. And that's no joke. My parents thought I needed to do it again. This one counselor who I was buying cocaine from, by the way, told my parents that I had an alcohol and drug problem and I needed to go into a treatment center. So in 1982, I went into the care unit in Jacksonville Beach, Florida, and I was there for 3 months, and I was pissed. I was not a good treatment participant. I don't like to follow rules. I never have. I heard Peg Martin describe it once. I always think that the rules don't apply to me. And I really believe that and have lived my life that way. You know, I'll do what I need to do while you're looking, but the instant you turn your back, I'm going to do it my way. And if I get caught, I'll be sorry for a little while. And I might even have some genuine remorse, but it's not going to last very long. And that's the nature of me. Unrecovered, that's how I operate. So anyway, so I'm not a good, as a matter of fact, you know, when you're in treatment, if you're good, you get to move up levels or days and you get more privileges. When I left treatment, and I was in there for 3 months, when I left treatment I was on level one, day one. So I didn't do a good job while I was there. And when I got out, I had to start going to AA meetings, and my mom used to drop me off at the AA clubhouse. That's the worst. And back then in 1982, you could still smoke in smoke hanging. And, you know, there's the coffee pot and very old people in that meeting, crusty old dudes running around in that meeting. And I was angry that I had to be there. I didn't want to be there. And at that point, when I came in that area of the country, there wasn't a lot of young people coming in. And I'll never forget this guy saying to me, "Valerie, you need to go home. You're still young. Do what your parents are telling you to do. Go to church. Be a good girl. You don't have to do what we have done." And I said, "So you don't think I'm an alcoholic?" He said, "No." So he goes, "No, you haven't gotten that bad," or however he said that. What I heard is, "You're not an alcoholic." So it became my personal mission to prove I was an alcoholic to this man. So I started showing up at their meetings drunk. I stole the key to the AA clubhouse. That's where I take my friends to go party, was at the AA clubhouse. I stole their money. They used to put their money after meetings into this Coke machine. And any good thief knows all you need is a hanger. And you can stick that down in there and pull it out, and that's what I'd use to drink. That was my drinking money. They always used to wonder, "What's happening to our money?" I don't know. You know? I mean, because we're liars. Oh, I'm a liar. I lie about anything, everything. It doesn't matter. Habitual, chronic liar. I lie even when I don't want to lie. I don't even know where I learned to lie. I just lied. Ever since I can remember, I've been a liar. So anyway, not a good AA member. Not a good upstanding AA member. I didn't want to sponsor, because then, you know, they're messing around in your life, trying to tell you what to do. I didn't want any of that. It was going to interfere with my lifestyle. I didn't think I was really an alcoholic. I was going to AA because of consequences. That's why I was going. And I was going in and out, in and out, in and out, in and out. I don't think I ever got more than 3 months at a time, maybe six. And it would just show up when I got in trouble. And, you know, would hang out in the clubhouse for a while. And when I was 17, though, I got into a lot of legal trouble with my pursuit of alcohol. And the option was given to me, either get sober or you're going back to juvie. And, of course, I'm going to choose sobriety. I'll get sober again. But I had hit a bottom. As much as a 17-year-old can, I was at the end of my rope. And I surrendered. And I said, I will never, ever drink again. And I meant it. I really meant it. And my father was now sober about 5 years, and he was living in L.A., so... And family relations were strained in Florida, so I went to L.A. and conned and manipulated my way out there. My dad wanted me to, like, work the steps before I came out there. I didn't want anything to do with that. So what I did was whip out the 12 and 12, read up, call him, and just kind of make up something and say, yeah, I just completed steps 1, 2, and 3, and this is what I learned. You know, I didn't do anything. I just read a book because I wanted to get out of there. I wanted to get out of where I was. Because, you know, it's all their fault. And it'll be different when I'm with you because you understand and you're in AA and all of that stuff. So I got out there, and he said the moment I got off the plane, he knew. He knew that nothing had changed. And that's so true with us. And I'm sure people that have been around for a little while, something happens when we wake up spiritually. We change, and people see it like that. They just see it. They know. We sound different. We look different. We're taking different actions. We're compelled to go help other people. Can't get away from it. You know, some crazy stuff is going on. And anyway, so he knew. And so I ran around Los Angeles for a while. My favorite place to hang out was the 502 Club in Covina, California. And the saying there was, who's on who at the 502? And that was the place for me. I loved it. As a matter of fact, this guy named Big Book Mac, he said, girl, you need to sit down, shut up, keep your legs crossed, because you're missing it. And I went to a meeting every day, though. I was in a meeting every day. Went to we called them the 13th Step Dances, looking for love and AA at the dances, which quickly moved to the parking lot. And we were just crazy. We were just insane. I was just running around. AA was very social to me. It was not about, I'm going to die from this. I just got into a lot of trouble. When I look back on that, I know I did not understand what it meant to be an alcoholic. I didn't get it at all. I didn't understand what AA was about. And I don't know if I heard that message or not. What I heard was, don't drink, go to meetings. That's what we do here. And, you know, I had a sponsor, which my father picked for me. And the only reason I let him pick her for me was he was making financial amends to me for pilfering mine and my brother's trust fund when we were younger. And, you know, but getting that amends, I was harassing because he was up last weekend, or this past last weekend for my anniversary. And, I was harassing because he was making financial amends to me, but every time I went to go pick up that check, a lecture ensued, you know, about how I needed to straighten up and fly right and all that other stuff. And I was like, Dad, I thought amends were supposed to be free, you know? I know something now. I didn't know anything then, you know. Now I know. But anyway, So I, you know, that's what I did in AA. I ran around, chased boys. I led a very ugly life sober. I got very, very, very spiritually sick sober. I was doing things sober that I hadn't even done drunk. So I know that alcohol is just a symptom of what's wrong with me. No question. No question. I slowly developed into somebody sober with no conscience. I could do a lot of things and feel nothing whatsoever. Nothing. Stark raving sober. Very, very sick. So alcoholism is progressive, and I need something that's bigger than my alcoholism. So as a result of living that way, and you know, I'll talk more about that, but living that way, I drank, and it happened just like that. Somebody said, do you want a drink? I said, yes, I do. Just like that. Three and a half years gone. And I stayed out there for 4 years. I moved to Atlanta. I tried the sheep experiment. It's going to be a sheep herder. And I thought that whole back to nature, cleaning out the barn, hugging trees, that kind of thing, was going to solve my problem. It wasn't alcohol. When I drank, my mind got around that really quick. I was too young. Fear sheep drunk, bad idea. And I say this with all honesty, it's a good thing I wasn't a man. I would have had carnal knowledge of those sheep. I see how that happens. They look good. They do. I'm not kidding. Not to offend, but it's true. I remember sitting drunk in one of the sheep stalls, just looking at it, and I got it, you know what I mean? But I'm a pig that way, you know what I mean? So it wasn't a big jump for me. So Atlanta for a couple years. I went to New York for a couple years. I hit my bottom in New York. My father, in essence, 12-stepped me back into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I wasn't looking for it. I wasn't like, God, I've had enough. The only thing that was different was I heard him. Because before that, I'd been avoiding his calls at all costs. And when I got on the phone with him, I had very little to say. But for some reason that night, and I'd been out on a binge and doing what I do when I drink, which is raise complete hell and harm everybody in my path. And I said, when I move down to Richmond, Virginia, I'm going to get sober. It never occurred to me that I couldn't make that decision and make it happen. Because I'd always said, oh yeah, I'm going to go back to AA and get sober. And then I'd go back to AA for a little while and drink for a little while, not drink for a little while at least. So when I got down to Richmond, I went to an AA meeting and it was the Phoenix Group. I was arising from the ashes. I thought it was very symbolic. No grandiosity here. And anyway, but I felt like I was home. And I'd never felt like that in Alcoholics Anonymous before, and I felt like I was home. I felt like they read How It Works, and I felt like I heard it for the very first time. It made sense to me. I knew that's where I was supposed to be. I got a sponsor that night. That's unusual behavior for me. She ended up being committed 2 weeks later, but she was perfect for me for those first 2 weeks. No joke, she's crazy. And I was crazy, bouncing off the walls. But I got sponsored right away. I called her every day. I did what she asked me to do. I was willing. And I ended up drinking two more times, and I had no intention of drinking whatsoever. None. And my last drink actually happened up in Minneapolis, Minnesota. I had gone up there to see an artist. I was representing artists at the time. And I was in his studio, and he had a bottle of Jack in his studio on the table. And he said to me, do you want a shot? I said, yes, I do. And I wanted to be here. And for me, it was a great experience because, you know, our book talks about no matter how great the necessity or the desire, it's not enough for an alcoholic of our type. That I truly am powerless over this disease. I did not want to drink. Everything in me wanted to be an Alcoholics Anonymous. I was doing exactly what you guys were asking me to do. I wanted to be here. So anyway, that night, and it was awful too because I'd just gotten two shots down and my now deceased ex-husband showed up to pick me up and I'd only gotten two shots down, which is the worst, interrupting somebody when they've only had two. And I was a real nice person the rest of the day. And later that evening, after everybody had gone to bed, I'm going upstairs to drink because I'm going to finish off the job. And I just asked God for help. I said, God, help me. And that is the only thing, I think, that kept me from finishing off the job. And I've been sober since then. It hasn't been necessary for me to take a drink since then. So sobriety's been really interesting. My sobriety date is October 13th, 1992. So I just celebrated 15 years. My home group is a Jaywalkers group. We meet on Tuesday nights and on Friday nights. Tuesday nights we've got a speaker meeting. It's an hour and a half meeting, 2 10-minute speakers, a break, and then our main speaker. Our Friday night meeting is a 45-minute newcomers meeting, and I love that meeting. Maybe I'll talk about that more too. But and then we have a 15-minute break, and then we have a closed discussion meeting. So my home group just got done meeting, and I love them dearly. They have saved my life on numerous occasions. Should we take a break? Is it break time?
No.
All right. Prayed up, and you know, I'm all nervous, and so I want to, you know, impress you all, of course. And he said, that's a waste of your time. But anyway, I said, so Jerry, they don't allow smoking in this place. And he goes, great opportunity for you to really practice reliance upon your higher power, your creator. I'm like, thanks, Jerry. He's been giving me a hard time about not smoking for quite a while. And Don used to say to me all the time about my smoking, he'd go, you're missing out on some spiritual stuff, kid. Which, you know, tell me what it is. I want to know what it is. I don't have to stop smoking to figure it out. Just give it to me. Which reminds me of another story with Don. You know, I was when I started getting sponsored by Don, I was probably 4 or 5 years sober, somewhere around in there. And I remember calling him one day, and I'm like, Don, tell me what to do. You know, because I want him to run my life. I want my sponsor to run my life. I don't want to make any mistakes, because if I do the wrong thing, I'm going to experience pain, and I don't want to experience pain or discomfort. And I want to do everything perfectly. And I said to Don, tell me what to do, tell me what to do. And he said to me, quit trying, you're such a thief. Quit trying to steal my experience. Go pray. Go follow the directions. Go pray. Go get quiet. Ask for guidance and direction. Follow that. And if it's the wrong thing, you can do something else. I did not like that direction. I want a sure thing. I want a sure answer. I want safety in all things. And what I started to learn from that was that my Creator is within me while I walk with you guys and travel this path with you guys. I've got this little nest within that I nurture with prayer and being quiet and taking the actions of AA that allow me to go out into the world and live and to carry all these things into all of my affairs. So I'm not hiding out in Alcoholics Anonymous. And that was, I won't say beaten into me, but it was, I was sponsored strongly with that idea. That I'm not to hide out in AA, that I've got to take this way of life and these principles into my work life, into my home life, into my home group, into my relationships with the women I sponsor, in my friendships, my family, besides, you know, my extended family. And I've had amazing experiences as a result of just trying to live this way and making many mistakes. I was talking to Tom yesterday. I used to be so afraid and very rigid. Don used to tell me all the time, lighten up. It's only a matter of life or death here. You know? I didn't like that either. I'm like, what does that mean? You know? I was this big thinker. I used to think a lot and try to wrap my mind around this way of life and wrap my mind around spiritual principles and wrap my mind around my Creator, because I want to be God in my life. I want to dictate the path that I will take. And I also, while we're at it, I'll dictate to you what you need to be doing in order to make my path more comfortable. And you'll love it. It's a great plan. Once I explain it to you and get you on board, you're going to be really excited about it. Hasn't happened yet. I was talking to Bernadette, too. I was like, I've always thought I've known what I've needed, and I haven't been right once. Not once. Not even one time. And that's probably a good thing, because then I'd probably try it again. You know what I mean? Think that this is going to be the time again. What have I found out that AA is all about? What I have found out that AA is all about, ultimately, is about service. That's what it's about. In all my affairs. Period. That's it. And we have these really cool tools that help get me prepared to go do that in the most effective way possible. And as spiritually fit as I can bring to the table at that moment. But it's about service. And I see a lot of people, even service junkies, who miss that. I probably shouldn't say that, but that's what I mean. I just got back from assembly, too. That's chalk. Oh, God, they're going to hate me for saying this. Can we mute this? Mute. In my travels in Alcoholics Anonymous, I have noticed that there are service junkies. And after a while, I see them become burnt on this way of life of just service. And they become burnt out, and they miss the spirit of that. So, you know, when I was about 3.5 years sober, I started to go insane. And I should tell you this, I've done AA just by every way that you can do AA. I've done Hazelton, the Hazelton Steps. I've done Joe and Charlie. I've done the 7 questions. I have done the Course in Miracles. That's not all AA, but that's the stuff that I was introduced to in AA as this is the way. The 12 and 12, taking the steps out of the 12 and 12. And God knows what else, whatever else I could come up with too, probably. So at about 3.5 years, I started to lose my mind. And what I was doing then was bits and pieces of the big book, a meeting every day, pick up a drunk every day, carry him to a meeting every day, that kind of thing. And I was ready to shoot myself. And I thought AA didn't work. I was very angry at God. I thought, like, I've been doing all this in AA. Look at everything that I've been doing. Why is this happening to me? Why is this happening? I was on the floor, like suicidal depressed, on the floor. It was absolutely my dark night. Everything that I had a dependency on was taken away. I know what it means to be in sobriety, to have nothing, to be stripped of everything. No car, no job, no money, no place to live. People in AA saying, go away. You need to be committed. You're crazy. Stay away from her. She's really sick. She will bring you down. And I was crazy. I got really, really nuts. And started carrying a gun again. That's not a good idea. It's a bad idea. Very paranoid. And would just go from complete rage and just, I can't, y'all know what I'm talking about. And then just on the floor, just wanting to die. And if this is it, I don't want it. And one night I set out purposely to drink and it didn't happen. Shortly after that I met Camille Frey in Louisville, Kentucky. And that woman saved my life. I met her at a conference that I didn't want to go to. And she looked at me and she goes, girl, you're a mad dog alcoholic. and you're going to die. She sounded like a bad Louisiana psychic. You're going to die unless you get into, you know, unless you get into all three parts of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm like, I am in all three parts of AA, and it doesn't work. And I heard hope in her because she was sharing her story, and she talked about being 12 years sober, sitting with a shotgun waiting for her man to walk in the door because she was going to blow the old boy away. And I identified with that. And I said, I love her. She understands me. And I asked her to help me. And my life has never been the same since. So what I did, I borrowed money, and I went out to see her in Louisville, Kentucky. And she talked to me. She talked about being in all three parts of Alcoholics Anonymous. I had never heard that before. I'm like, what are you talking about? And, you know, and she talked to me about our circle and triangle and about recovery. And she asked me some questions about, well, what have you done with the steps? Tell me about that. Well, there's some things I left off of inventory, and this is how I wrote it. And I wrote it, the last inventory I'd done was the checkmark thing. And but there were things that I had left off of that, and there were amends that I was never, ever, I mean ever, going to make. They owed me amends. And I had a lot of whole choice, lovely words that started with MF that went along with those people. And it was not going to happen. And she didn't fight me with that. She said, well, if I'm walking with you, you do it or see you later. Love you, mean it. Don't waste my time. And it was good that she spoke to me in that way, because I don't know that I would have heard it any other way. And, you know, she talked to me about the unity piece of this program. And unity was about convenience to me. That's how I conducted myself in Alcoholics Anonymous. I showed up late. I would leave early sometimes. I was at my home group. That was not a committed meeting to me unless I was there, unless I was really tired. Or I had something better to do. Something better came up. And she told me, she goes, you will be there unless you are dead sick or out of town. And I'm like, that's harsh. And she goes, and when I say sick, I mean sick. Not any of this mamby-pamby stuff you like to pull. And she had me nailed, because I like mamby-pamby. I don't feel good today. You know, I hurt today. You know, what's my favorite ailment, you know? And she said, you know, how are you being of service to Alcoholics Anonymous? Are you a taker in AA? And, hell yeah, I'm a taker in AA. Yeah, I am. I give when it's convenient to me. Are you willing to be inconvenienced by Alcoholics Anonymous? Are you willing to be inconvenienced by the newcomer? So I was so desperate. Thank God for desperation. I said, I will go anywhere and do anything that you're asking me to do. And she says, well, we're going to start at the beginning. And where it says write, we're going to write. When it says pray, we're going to pray. When it asks a question, we're going to answer it. When it says go here and do that, we're going to go there and do that. And that's the deal. Are you willing? And I said, yes, I am. And so I started taking the steps out of the big book ever since then. And it changed my life. So that's the message that I carry today. She had me do a lot of things that I didn't understand and I didn't agree with. You know, and one of the things that she said to me, she goes, well, Val, you know, they're not lying in the big book. What they're saying in there is true. You know, Valerie, and she put it in terms that I could understand. If it said that sleeping with newcomers was a great way to gain spirituality, it'd be in there, wouldn't it? But it's not, because it doesn't work. You know what I mean? So she put it in terms I could understand. She had me nailed. And my life was a train wreck. Train wreck. I didn't know how to live at all. I mean, unmanageability everywhere. Everywhere. And very angry. And I was telling Tom, I'm happy to report that I haven't had the cops called on me in a long time. Because if you pissed me off, I'd go after you physically. And I'm, you know, something that Don used to say, I'm just not capable of doing that anymore. I couldn't do that even if I wanted to. And that's absolutely God changing me, because that's how I handled anger ever since I can remember. If you made me mad, I was coming to get you. And I saw real value in that. One of the things that I love about our fourth step is that I can't fool myself about the value of my character defects anymore. And with my anger, for a long time, I still had a lot of value with that. And because it kept you off balance. And if I scared you bad enough, you'd do what I wanted you to do. It'd keep you away from me. If I needed to get you away from me, I could get my way with it. And where I hit bottom with that is I was around 7 years sober, and I was at my home group. And there was a woman who came in, and it was a closed discussion meeting. And she was introducing herself as an addict. And it was my duty after the meeting, being little Miss AA that I have now graduated to, because I am armed with facts now. I'm dangerous. You know what I'm saying? I know something now. I'm on fire! And truly, I was like, I became a little, you know, I hate to use the term, but it's true. I mean, that's how I was labeled, too. I became a big book Nazi. And hate to use that word, but that's, you get the picture. Big book thumper. I was a thumper. And anyway, so this gal says to me, and the traditions too, and I'm laying down the AA law, and I'm coming after the people that are trying to destroy AA, and I'm going to save them. I'm going to set them straight. You know? So I was on a mission. And anyway, so this gal, she introduced herself as an addict in the meeting. It's a closed meeting of AA. So after the meeting, I thought it was my personal responsibility as a good home group member to go up and inform her of her error. And so I go up and I say something to her, and she says, are you the AA police? You can't tell me what to do. I can come into this meeting and I can do whatever I want. I'm like, are you talking to me right now? Are you talking to me? And she went on and on, and I mean, I was like a peacock. It just went, and I was mad. And then it began, where I'm gonna rip off your top part, except I was voicing it very loud. I'm gonna rip it off and shove it up your bottom part. Other home group members are running around. Little kids are running around because we have babysitting at our meeting. People that came to visit the meeting that were trying to get off the ground. And it's a big book meeting, which was like, ooh, taboo in Richmond for a very long time. We didn't talk about that stuff. So we got people visiting, trying to check it out. And that's the example of solid big book AA that I'm demonstrating. And I mean, and I'm yelling and screaming at the top of my lungs and cussing up one side and down the other. And then the guy that brought her, I get a hold of him, and I'm yelling and screaming at him and ripping him a new one and just going to town. And I don't know who stopped me, but I got separated from that situation and went into the bathroom to pray. And I knew right away I was wrong. Knew right away. And I made amends right away. And I went back out there. And they, she has never come back to that meeting. The guy has come back with his new woman. And he stays far away from me. And I've talked to him several times since then, and just, you know, I was dead wrong. You know, what can I do? Is there anything I can do to make it right? I scared the bejesus out of him. And I'm lucky they didn't call the cops that night. I mean, I really am. And I had to get up in the morning and make amends to the parents and the home group members. And I was in bad shape with that. I paid an awful price with that, spiritually, and emotionally, and I haven't had that since. And I'll never forget calling Don the next day, and the only thing that he asked me was, why were you so threatened? And that's a great question to ask. When I'm ready to go to war, why am I so threatened? Because I like going to war. War is fun. You know, I can get a lot of power out of going to war, especially if I think I'm right. So I've never forgotten that question, and I ask that of myself frequently. Why do I feel so threatened right now? What's going on? Is it break time yet?
Yes.
It's break time! Yay! Smoker's Tribe. Well, I have no idea what to say now. You know, where do you start? And I'm just praying and asking that my Creator guide me and direct me. Do we have a question from the crowd?
You were going to tell us why you were threatened.
Oh, I was?
Yes.
Well, what came out of that is I was afraid that I was doing it wrong. I was afraid I was wrong and that she was right. And my beliefs and convictions were so new. I was so very fragile with them, I think. And anybody that questioned me on my newfound fire and passion, I would automatically get into an argument with them and defend my experience, it was my newfound knowledge. And so I think that was a large part of it, was what if I'm wrong? And I didn't like it. I didn't know what to do when people disagreed. All I knew how to do was go to war if you disagreed with me. And very, very invested in being right. And that little saying around AA, I thought was just complete hooey. You know, would you rather be right or happy? And I'm like, what kind of choice is that? You know, I mean, that made no sense to me whatsoever. I thought that was pretty mamby-pamby response. Something that my current sponsor today, Jerry, said to me, I don't know what I had my knickers in a twist about, but I was probably defending something. And he said, Valerie, what I have learned is that everybody's right. Everybody's right, even when they're wrong. I was like, whoa, that's true. And I like that, even when they're wrong, because I want to hang my hat on that, you know, because I still got a little oomph there. But more and more I see how true that is, we really do cease fighting anything or anyone. Which is paramount for somebody like me, to cease fighting. And every time I have ceased fighting, it's always worked out fine. And usually in ways that I didn't expect, and better than anything I could have planned. I used to hate to hear that too. God's will for you is better than anything you could have planned. And I remember too, I used to have some real issues with the spiritual way of life, or with this God reliance thing. And I was very afraid of God. And I remember calling Don up one time, and I was very uptight, you know, very rigid kind of a girl. And I don't remember what was going on. All I knew was that I was praying, and I wanted relief from my mind and from my emotions, because they were on me like this. I couldn't get them off. So I'm praying, and I'm afraid that I'm praying wrong. I want to pray just right. I got to say it perfectly, or I'm going to get no relief. And I called him up, and I said, I'm praying, and it's not working. You know, this stuff, you know, you seem to have some kind of special connection to God. I do not have that. And he said, well, Valerie, and I've been through the steps by this point several times. Out of our big book, and so I was surprised to find myself in this place, and I was surprised at what came out of my mouth
actually. Because intellectually, I knew differently. But out of my mouth, he goes, well, what are you praying to? Tell me about what you're praying to. Tell me about your conception of God. And I said, God is punishing, and God is vindictive. And if you don't do this spiritual stuff just right, you're never going to go anywhere, and you're never going to be happy, and you got to suffer for God, and you got to suffer for a spiritual way of life. I mean, just like, blah, all this stuff came out, and it was not a good story, you know? And he said to me, he said, Valerie, you've got God set up as a version of you. And I was like, wow, that's a low blow. Thanks. But that was true, because I am all of those things. I am vindictive, punishing, play favorites. Like, I thought there were the haves and the have-nots in the spiritual life, and I would always be a have-not. I would always be somebody who was struggling with this spiritual answer. I would never get it. And, you know, I'd hear these great speakers that I just adored in Alcoholics Anonymous who seemed to get it. And I just used to, you know, judge them, because I wanted what they had, but I didn't understand how they got that. And I thought, it will happen for them, but it's never going to happen for me. And then, you know, Camille said to me, well, are you willing to do what they have done? If you want what they have, are you willing to do what they have done? And also, you know, I was never happy where I was at. When I was 2 years sober, I wanted to be 20 years sober. When I was 5 years sober, I wanted to be 25 years sober. Not comfortable at all where I'm at currently today. I always wanted to be somewhere different, different and better. In my mind, it was different and better. Now I understand a little bit more about the journey and being present in today. And also today, very grateful for my character defects. And not afraid of suffering at all. And that's a complete change for someone like me. Because I would try to control my experience in my life so to insulate myself from that stuff. And because I want to feel good all the time. Unless I'm on a tear. If I'm on a tear, the worse I feel, the better. And I like to nurse it. And I like to feed it. Feel some misery with it. Go down dark with it. Go on to lockdown. You know what I mean? And I can find power in that too. Love to be the victim of my own mind, you know, and woe is me. It's a son of a bitch being me. You know what I mean? So full of shit. But anyway, so I don't fear suffering at all. And not that I'm asking for any to be delivered. But when it comes, it's okay. I know that there is another side to that. And I don't care when it shows up. I'm not attached to a time frame anymore. Like, I'd be like watching, waiting. I don't feel better today. I don't feel better today. When's this going to get better? I'm working with newcomers. When's it going to get better? I'm throwing myself into AA. When's it going to get better? You know, all that stuff that we get told to do. Well, go find a newcomer. You know, get your head out of your buttocks. Go work with a newbie, you know. Go pick up some drunk and take them to the meeting. Do you have inventory to write? Do you have, you know, whatever. Do you have unfinished amends? I mean, I can get so wound tight with, have I done this perfectly? Because I shouldn't be feeling this. I'm feeling this, so something's wrong. You know, I mean, and going into a mental whirlwind, my friend calls it a psychic shitstorm. And I like that. That describes it perfectly. So today, I just don't fight with that much anymore. And I have, my faith has changed. You know, one of the things that I love in the We Agnostics, where it talks about we have to make that step from bridge to shore. And for me, what that meant is I had to leave my mind and what I knew and really start to trust this voice that was starting to talk to me within, because it was starting to happen. And all my life, I had been running from that, running. And then it got so bad where it was just completely shut off, where it was gone. You know, and I come back into AA and it starts to open up a little bit more. I start to have a conscience again. I can't do the same things that I used to be able to do. And it was frightening for me to start trusting that. And I remember, too, this one instance, and it kind of changed my faith and was like a stepping stone for me, where I trusted my gut and what I was being directed to do. And on paper, it was something that someone like me should not be doing. And Don used to tell me all the time, Valerie, and this had to do with work, follow your heart's desire. Do what God intended you to do. We all have a contribution to make. We've all been given the gift to do it. Go do it. Well, I can't do that. I dropped out of high school. You got to be educated to go do this. There's no way it's going to work out. You know, at that point, Camille had made me go back and get my GED in sobriety. I had dropped out of high school a long time ago. And but Don said, this is about the world of the spirit. And I don't care what you think you know about this. Because I shared with him about what was going on in my gut. And it was to go teach. And I couldn't go teach because I didn't have a college education. So my next option was to be a trainer. And so I started interviewing these trainers and finding out what they did and all this stuff and doing some volunteer training in correctional facilities. Now that's a joke. I have to tell you about that. I digress for one second. But it was a good thing because then we got a meeting started in the jail. So I did this volunteer training, and I go in to do this training, and it's about with offenders, it's moral psychology. If you help them to understand the consequences of their behavior and the impact that it has on other people, they will go forth and never sin again. And I'm reading this stuff going, this is a crock of poo. I can't train this. We're starting a meeting in here. Because most of the people that were in that room were addicts and alcoholics. And I just could not, in good conscience, continue on with that training. So we started a meeting, and I didn't do that training. But I was willing to put myself out there. I was willing to follow my gut. And everything in the world told me, you can't do it. People in the world said, it can't be done. You don't have an education. You have no experience. And Don said, yeah, whatever. Put it together and send it out. Put together your skills and send it out. And I did, and I got a job 2 weeks later. I couldn't believe it. And making more money than I'd ever made in my life, and I was making it honestly, which was a different experience for me. And I was learning how to become self-supporting through my own contributions. All my life I've been a thief, in every way that you can be a thief. I stole from everybody. I was an equal opportunity thief. I didn't care. I'd steal from anybody under any circumstances at any time, and I did. So I've learned how to, I've grown up in AA, I guess, and learned how to become self-supporting through my own contributions, like pay my bills, not be a spiritual thief, not be an emotional thief. You know, I used to go to people, tell me what to think, tell me what to believe, you know, all that stuff. You know, and thank God for strong sponsorship that said, you know what, you go figure it out and let me know. And I don't mean that to say that I didn't get strong direction. I got very strong direction. But, like, they knew when to let me go. They knew that line. And I think as a sponsor, you know, it's a conversation that I have with Jerry. You know, when am I giving direction, and then when am I trying to run their life? And sometimes it seems like a very fine line, which requires so much prayer, which is good. Good thing about sponsorship, the little shits will make you pray. So that probably wasn't very nice, was it? But it's true, you know. But I went off on a tangent. So anyway, so that was like a turn for me, that trusting God was good, that trusting God was okay, that really what God has planned for me really is anything, it's better than anything I can come up with. It really is. And so I don't fear God's will anymore. I used to be afraid of God's will. I was like, oh my God, that means I'm going to have to never have sex again in my life. I'm going to have to be a nun in South America and be poor. That was my vision of doing God's will. It was bad, you know? And I'm like, I can't, what an order I can't go with. And, you know, and Don said to me, is it possible that maybe God's already got somebody going down there doing that? And if you were directed to do that, that it would be okay. And my God, that sounds better than what you got going on anyway right now. You know? Which was true. So my recovery life has been all over the map. A lot of different things, which I guess we'll talk more about tomorrow when we start to get into those steps a little bit more deeply. Is everybody tired or not tired? You want me to keep going? I'm trying to, because it's Friday. I'm fine. I can keep going.
Keep going?
Okay. Well, y'all will leave if you're tired, right? When the room starts to thin, I'll shut up. So what else? Is anybody here questioning whether they're an alcoholic? Leo's going. If Leo's going, it's time to go. You just hurt my feelings. I'm kidding. Is anybody here not clear on whether they're an alcoholic or questioning that? Does everybody think it's okay to question whether you're an alcoholic?
Yes.
Sweet. See, y'all are like on the page. Actually, I think it's time to stop because I'm done on the inside. It's done. It's quiet. There's nothing else coming. So I'm done. And telling stories and stuff. And just about our alcoholic mind, or our mind that is just unbelievably insane. And the stuff that we come up with that really seems like a good idea. It's always entertaining. Until we go to jail. But anyway, so really, really excited about being here. It's just really neat. It's really neat. And it's neat to be with AA family out west that I didn't know really well yet. And I run around a lot on the East Coast, and it's been really neat. And getting to spend time with you guys out here. And AA has become my family. I never fit in anywhere else. I desperately tried to and wanted to, but I never fit in anywhere else. I was always very awkward and never really fit in with a group. And I would move from group of people to group of people to group of people, either by the consequence of my actions, you know, I'd wear out my welcome in a group. And I was just weird. I was just strange. And always doing and saying the wrong thing, and their things would go missing. So, you know, just not a very nice person at all, and just very awkward. And when I got into AA, you know, and started to recover and started to get well and really started to be a part of this incredible fellowship that we have, and started to be a member of life. And it was because of what happened to me in Alcoholics Anonymous. So when I go to work today, I don't feel like odd man out. I don't feel separated from everybody. when I'm with my family and they're all lunatics, I don't feel like odd man out or that I have to change them or whatever. And I'll talk more about that. And that's just because of what Alcoholics Anonymous has done for me. And I found that first here, that sense of understanding and acceptance, and then being shown a way to live that I just could not find before. And the only place I ever got relief from all the uncomfortability was, of course, through alcohol. So I want to tell you a little bit about my experience with these steps. When I got sober this last time, I was really desperate and willing to go to any length. And this is crazy, but if people had told me, Valerie, if you go stand in the corner on your head and that's going to keep you sober, I would have done it. I had gotten to that point where I was willing to go anywhere, do anything, if it meant that I didn't have to be me anymore or lead the life that I was leading. I was married at that time. My son was 2. My life was very ugly, but on the outside it looked great. My first husband made pretty good money, but I was not a good wife. I was not a good mother. I was one of those women that would drop their kid off and say, I'll be back in a couple hours and not come back. I'd come back when I was done drinking. And sometimes I'd be 10 hours later. Sometimes it'd be a day and a half later. Sometimes I'd only be an hour late. But once I started drinking, something happened where I had to keep drinking. And again, I don't care what the price is I have to pay. That I just don't care. And that's the point I got to. I really didn't care. And I would show remorse if it was fitting. If I could get you off my back. When I would get into arguments with Steve, who was my first husband, about my drinking and stuff, and come home, be a good wife, this isn't what I signed up for. I'd do whatever I had to do to appease him, so I could go out and do what I wanted to do. And I did exactly what I wanted to do. I absolutely did not consider other people or the harm I was causing him or my son at all. That's not a nice person. And for a long time, I had this delusion that I was a nice person, that I was a good person. And I'm not. Left on my own steam, I am not a kind person at all. I will be like the tornado, like our book talks about, running through your life. As a matter of fact, when I went to go make amends to him, he told me, he goes, Valerie, that 4 years I was with you were the worst 4 years of my life. That's not a stunning recommendation, you know what I mean? Because we run through people's lives. And create all kinds of damage, and then completely arrogant about it. Like, get over it. Get over it. And I really used to feel that way and think that way. Get over it. I've been appropriately sorry. I've been appropriately remorseful. Get over it. And getting mad at you for still being mad at me. You know? That's why I love, when we're new and we come into AA, it's like, God, I've been sober a whole 3 months and they still won't, they don't trust me. You know? They still won't talk to me. You know, we're such idiots with that stuff. And I mean, it took 5 years before my mom, I think, really believed that I was sober and not going to take something from her. So, and that's been an incredible demonstration in my family. But so, when I got here, I was really willing, and I got a sponsor. And I told you about that last night. She got committed, and then I got another gal who ended up not being an alcoholic. She ended up leaving Alcoholics Anonymous. Her name was Joanne. She was just having a rough patch, and she came into AA, and just a small suicide attempt. And with some booze involved. But she wasn't one of us. She was just having a rough patch. But she was in AA and running around, and she sponsored me for a while and called her every day, and I thought she was an alcoholic because she told me she was. And you know, and she took me through the steps out of Hazleton. About 9 months sober, I lost my mind and started bouncing off the walls really, really bad. And I had left Steve. Once I sobered up, I left my first husband. I left him and started doing some construction work and cleaning houses and stuff. I didn't know anything about living in the world at all. I didn't know how to pay bills, do a checkbook, any of that stuff, because I always found somebody to take care of me. So I didn't know anything about that, like paying rent and paying it on time, and you get in trouble if you don't. That kind of stuff, that I have to actually be responsible for a car and making sure it's legal. I had no clue about that stuff. I'm happy to report that my car is completely legal today. All speeding tickets have been paid. That's for a long time. I mean, nothing was legal. I didn't pay my tickets. When I left California, and I this was sober before. Well, my friend in North Carolina calls it sobriety. I'm sober, but I'm dry. Sobriety. But when I left California, when I was sober for that 3.5 years, I think I had 13 warrants out for my arrest when I left that I had racked up stark raving sober. And just not paying attention, the rules don't apply to me. You know, I just throw that stuff away and keep going, you know. But anyway, I feel like Tom this morning. I'm like, here's a story, then I jump over this story, and then I go over this story. So I left Steve, and whatever, I'm learning how to live, I'm learning how to work a little bit. I'm not very good at it at all. I'm not very good at showing up on time. Still not very good at being where I'm supposed to be when I say I'm going to be there. A lot of times I don't feel like working, so I don't. You might get a call from me, you might not. But I was going to a meeting and wanted to be here. You know, and something, you know, sometimes I forget when I'm working with new people, and it talks about us in our, I think it's in one of the prefaces, that we are very ill when we get here. Very sick people. I mean, I don't know anybody who comes into AA on a winning streak, you know. And AA is not known as an emotional and mental hotbed of great mental health, you know what I'm saying? So that when we get here, we're sick people. You know, to be compassionate and to remember. So I'm 9 months sober and I'm starting to go a little mad, and I started going to this big book meeting called The Fourth Dimension. And it got started, and they were big book thumping and all this good stuff, and it was great. You know, I had no idea that How It Works was in the big book. I'd heard it read in meetings for years, had no clue. I mean, if you want to hide something from a drunk, stick it in the big book, right? It's the last place they're ever going to look. And not a clue. So it was it was magic for me, because I was like, oh my God, there's directions in here. The first directions I discovered in the big book were the 11th step directions. And I started practicing those, and I just had a blast. I just had a great time, and I kind of had a spiritual experience. I woke up a little bit before, where God was very nebulous, and it's like, yeah, God, whatever. I'll pray because you tell me to. I had an experience, and it was like, God is here. You know, it was like a big blinking sign. It's like I woke up inside, that there was something going on here. Got excited about AA, got excited that there were these directions in there, and just started on that path and being a member of that home group. And I had, at that time too, I switched sponsors again because Joanne had gone out, and that sponsorship line that I was in was very, very big on commitment. And that's where I really started to learn about respect for Alcoholics Anonymous and being committed in AA. That's when those ideas started being introduced to me. And I didn't fully surrender to those because they were a tad inconvenient, but I started to hear that message. And was held somewhat accountable to that stuff. So I'm going along in sobriety, and of course I've gotten into a relationship, and he's the one. And it is absolutely God's will. We've been on, you know, 2 dates. We've slept together, of course, and it was magic, and he understands me. And I think I even said to my sponsor at the time, Nancy, I know it's God's will. I know God's direction, because we just connected. And and I've never had sex like that before in my life. And I mean, I'm sure she was like, yeah, whatever. But I'm glad that nobody can see that on tape, what I just did. But anyway, and she had been around, so she was laughing. You know, it was funny. But we really believe that. You know, we really believe that this is God's will. And so I got into this relationship, and it was insane. Of course, we moved in with each other right away. With that joke with you get two alcoholics together, you know, at the end of the first day, do you say the Lord's Prayer, or do you pack up the U-Haul, you know, and move in? We packed up the U-Haul, and he was at home living with his mama and daddy. And I'm like trying to learn how to live, can barely pay rent, and I mean, it was crazy. It was insane, but it seemed like a great idea at the time. And, and we're different. I listen to other people's experience in AA, and I listen to my sponsor's experience, and I'm different. And I remember thinking that I am different. What you're saying does not apply to me. I'm going to do it different. I'm listening to all the mistakes you made. I'm not going to do that. I'm going to do it different, because this is true love. True love. And, so anyway, disaster. Disaster ensues. Why? Because I don't have a relationship with God. It's brand new. It's just a baby. Just a baby relationship. And of course, this man becomes my higher power. and I start worshiping at the altar of Alex. And gets very sick. I start missing out on my commitments in AA. Start getting into arguments, so I don't go to the meeting, or I don't talk to that new girl, because we're arguing. That's more important, that we get this thing resolved. And it never, never got resolved that way, ever. So just a lot, just crazy time. The big dramatic breakups. Well, I'm going to go find some strange, because I'm mad at you, because I like to retaliate. So I'll go back to what I know. I'll just go find me a new boyfriend. That'll show you. And I might do it so you can catch me, and I might not, you know. Want to keep you off balance so you never know really what's going on. Because that's how I like to maintain control. And it's just insane. And having a hard time working, and because that becomes paramount in my life. That becomes the all-important thing. So I hit around 3 years. It's another breakup. It's nasty. It's ugly, and I hit another bottom in AA. And it was good. It's the most painful thing I've ever gone through in sobriety. And it took me a while. Sometimes I even hate to talk about how long it took me to come out of that. A lot of the reason why is because I added to it by the bucket load. But it was the turning point in my sobriety, and I am forever grateful for all of that stuff that went down at that time. At that time, the sponsorship that I was involved in, was about a meeting every day. Didn't really do the big book. It was about go find a new drunk and carry him to a meeting, and write me a letter once a week and let me know what's going on. And I started stealing in earnest again. I started going to work, and say I was working for a film producer at the time, And I said, well, I'm going to go into D.C. and make some calls on some prospective clients. He did corporate films and stuff. You know, try to find some. And then I'd just go home and get in bed, not go to work. And I talked about that a little bit last night. I eventually stopped working, couldn't work. Everybody in AA that I knew, my behavior became so bizarre that they were, literally, I was disowned by everyone I knew in AA. Stay away from me. I started getting, my anger started showing up in earnest. Small anger problem, small. I wasn't welcome at the Rebo Center, the sober center. It was just a really ugly time. It was a really painful time. You know, and he had left, and he had started dating someone else. Oh, I know, that's a bad one. So what's our natural response? I will stalk you. So, you know, how I added to that was, you know, by hiding behind bushes and underneath cars and vandalizing his things and scaring him. I mean, he...
I know.
It's a true story. And he told me later, he's like, you know, I was afraid. He goes, I didn't know what you were going to do. He goes, it was terrifying. I didn't know what you were going to do, what you were capable of doing. You were so weird. I mean, I had like bad vibes coming off of me. I'd go into the meetings where him and that girl were, and I'd just like stare hate, you know, and hope that they were feeling it, you know, because I had been wronged, and you know, and I was like the bad person, I was like the crazy person, and then he was the angel, and I'm like, you're all wrong, and I wanted to show him what a, you know, whatever. I wanted to prove to them, to everybody in AA, that he was bad, you know, and I was the victim, and how can y'all do this to me? And I just, it was just crazy. And then I met Camille, and literally the woman saved my life. If I hadn't have met her, I know I'd be drunk or dead. No question in my mind. No question. Because that's where I was headed. Because I got very angry at AA and very angry at God. I didn't understand why all that was happening to me. I thought God was punishing me. I thought that AA didn't work, that all you guys were a bunch of hypocrites, that you guys didn't walk what you talked, that I was in real trouble and you weren't helping me. You were just standing back there judging me. And I was in real trouble. And I tell you, Camille likes the crazy ones, I guess, because she just scooped me up. And she didn't pat me on the tutu or anything. She told me, you know, you're going to die. You're in real trouble. And there's some real work that we got to do here. So I became willing to do what she asked me to do, and she laid it out clearly. This